From the shores of Puget Sound, this is Greener Views, a unique media resource for information, education, consultation, and fun. Greener Views is a part of the Healthy Homecast Network and is brought to you exclusively by HealthyPainting.com and AmbrosiaDigitalMedia.com. Each episode will introduce and connect you with services, products, practices, organizations, and groups that focus on the health, happiness, safety, well-being, charity, and community of all. Find us on the web at www.greenerviews.net. And now, your host, Daryl Whalen.
Good evening and welcome to episode 47 of Greener Views. 47. That's amazing. So I'm Daryl Whalen here with Michael Schwartz and Randy Parcell, our audio-video dream team. And joining us this evening is Stephen Gilbert from, well, we'll say Toxopedia to start with, but there's a lot of other stuff. So Greener Views is part of the Healthy Homecast Network. It's brought to you exclusively by HealthyPainting.com and AmbrosiaDigitalMedia.com. If you'd like to advertise or be a sponsor or donate, please contact us at 206-650-4587 or email us info@greenerviews.net. So we generally start out by talking about how I know the guest. Stephen was on the show a little over a year ago.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly what episode it was, but we met when I was taking the Master Home Environmentalist training.
That's right.
Through the American Lung Association with so we've had Casey Coulomb on here. Mm-hmm. We've had Eileen Gagne. We've had Doug Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Pretty much had and we've had a number of the other instructors and stuff, so we've been really blessed. And so I think Stephen's the real, I think he's the real deal. You can decide what that means to you, but I feel really grateful that he's offered to come down and share what he's got going on and some of the updates and some of the older stuff and some of the stuff that we haven't talked about in the past. So welcome, and
thanks
for joining us. You're quite welcome.
Great
thanks
to be
for
here.
Joining us today. Do you want to start out with Toxopedia, or what do you want to start out with?
Well, Toxopedia is a good place to start. You know,
give us a brief elevator pitch. What is Toxopedia?
So Toxopedia is a free wiki-based site that tries to provide information about toxicology. So our goal is to put scientific information in the context of history, society, and culture. Because our view is you just can't keep throwing science on the wall. You really need to put it in context. So our goal is to try to make information accessible, because we view that we've got tremendous amounts of knowledge. When I came out of an academic environment, we spent a lot of time writing grants, and university environments know how to learn more and more about less and less. But that's not the challenge anymore. I think the real challenge is how do we make all the information we have accessible? And I think that's one thing I'm really excited to be here, is I think it's one thing you're working hard to do.
Great. So that would be Toxopedia.org?
Toxopedia.org, and you're welcome. We're always looking for contributors, and we have a number of other websites that go with Toxopedia. We've spun off a whole bunch, slew of websites. And one of them, for example, is about integrated pest management. It's called IPMopedia.org. So it looks at how to reduce pesticide use in your garden or your around your home and even in your house. And we have other sites on Washington Nuclear Museum and Education Center. We do a lot of work on Hanford and how to help people understand what happened to Hanford and the plutonium production out there. Maybe we can talk more about that.
We will.
And we've got a number of other sites there, Particles on the Wall, which also looked at Hanford a little bit. We have a site on the World Library of Toxicology. It looks at worldwide issues on toxicology. And we have one on Toxicology History Room. And we have a poster, Milestones of Toxicology. And I think one of our biggest sites we just brought up this year was called Small Dose of Toxicology, which supports our book, Small Dose of Toxicology, which is now out in its second edition, and it's a free ebook. And with that, we start up Healthy World Press, and we've published three books in Healthy World Press so far this year.
Hmm. So what exactly is toxicology?
So toxicology, the big thing it looks at is the effects of chemicals on human and environmental health. And I think the most key words of toxicology are dose response, how much of a dose of something produces what response. And I think most of us are familiar with caffeine. You take a little bit of caffeine and you get that response. Most of us have felt drinking too much caffeine. We can moderate the amount of caffeine. You probably felt a little bit of getting a headache when you stopped drinking caffeine. That's another response to caffeine. So what dose causes those issues? And that's where we look like a toxicology. Only we study things like lead, PCBs, bromated flame retardant, asbestos, cancer-causing, reproductive-causing problems, endocrine disruptors, bisphenol A, phthalates, which are common right now.
So, I'd like to think that, and by the way, everything on Greener Views is our opinion, and we talk about stuff, and we try to be as objective and stuff as possible, or subjective, I don't even know. But I'd like to think that at one point in time that the Earth was relatively pristine, and as time went on, things have changed and stuff, and that's just where I'm at. But at what point did toxicology start to become an occupation and a career and something that people started doing?
That's a really good question, because there's an incredible amount of history with toxicology. And we were concerned as a species, concerned with toxicology a long time ago, what plants and animals were toxic. And toxins have been used by plants and animals to defend themselves. Caffeine, for example, is actually a pesticide that's produced by plants to ward off insects. Nicotine is a classic pesticide, and it's actually been used as a pesticide concentrated out of tobacco plants. But so we've been involved in toxicology a long time. And you look back at the history of toxicology, for example, Shakespeare. There's toxicology in Shakespeare. Hmm. There's toxicology in almost every place you look. There's people concerned about the effects of chemicals on their bodies and how do we survive. And that partly came from food, but also interaction with the environment. And you look at lead, for example, the Roman Empire probably fell in part because of lead used in wine and lead used in our pipes. Hmm. And they didn't understand the toxic effects of lead at that time. And we've made tragic mistakes with lead, putting lead in gasoline, lead in paints, which we're still struggling to reduce. And that has a really detrimental effect on children's health. For example, the Center for Disease Control just lowered the blood lead action level from children from 10 to 5. And that was a huge deal. I've argued it should be at 2, but they finally lowered it to 5. But that's just, it goes along with our understanding that there's no safe level of lead exposure.
Hmm. Wow. So how did you, let's give a brief thing about what you do. I know you're an educator, and how did you get into that? Why don't you give us a brief bit about it in your background and how you got to do the stuff and talk about and be passionate about the things you are now?
So my interest was came out of lead and mercury research, where my concern was trying to protect children's environmental health and children's developing nervous systems.
Mm.
So we looked at very low-level exposure to lead and mercury and how that might affect the developing nervous system. And from there, a lot of this work I actually did in Canada. And then I moved to University of Washington, where I did more work on mercury. I left University of Washington after a while, partly because I felt like we knew a lot, but we weren't using our knowledge to make good policy decisions. We were just learning more and more. And I got sort of frustrated with writing grants about mercury when I felt like we knew enough about mercury to make good decisions. So from there, I went and got involved in the private sector, and I was president and part owner of a company called BioSupport, where we did contract work for the pharmaceutical and biotech industry.
Hmm.
And one thing I learned about working in that industry was that the pharmaceutical and biotech industry are interested in making money from disease. I mean, their whole focus is how do we make money from disease? They're not interested in preventing disease. They're interested in providing the next drug to treat some disease. So they're not focused. And I think that's a big problem in our society, is that we are not focused on prevention. And that was where my heart really was. So when I left the business side of things for a whole variety of reasons, I left that, wrote the book Small Dose of Toxicology, and really came back to my roots, which is how do we prevent disease and not so much treat it, but prevent it. So we're not exposing kids to toxicant material that affects the developing nervous system. Because my belief that we have an ethical responsibility to ensure all of our children can reach and maintain their full potential. And we're exposing them to lead and mercury, PCB, bromated flame retardants, I go down the alphabet soup of chemicals. We're robbing them of their potential.
Yeah.
You get me started here, so I can just roll on.
Well, I don't know. I got so many things going on through my mind. Is like, is ethical responsibility profitable?
No. That's a problem. I think that's a real problem, because there's not a lot of money made on prevention. There's money made from treatment, and I think that's one reason why you need a single-payer system here, that there is somebody focused on prevention. You look at Canada, and they banned the use of pesticides in lawn and environment in some provinces, partly because they recognize this is a problem for society. You need to prevent pesticide exposure, and we don't need it in sort of beautification of lawns. There's other ways to do that. We don't need to spread these pesticides around. So we need some entity that's focused on prevention. In the U.S. healthcare system, nobody focus on prevention because there's no money to be made in prevention. There's always only money made in treating disease.
Yeah. Wow. So originally, when we spoke about getting together this time, we started talking about nanotoxicology, correct?
Oh, yes.
So let's talk about a little bit about what the heck that is. Because, by the way, I am like the ultimate layperson. Yes. Generally, I'm mesmerized and inspired by a lot of things that you say, but I only know about a small percentage of it.
Well, small is all about nano. So, you know, my book, I joke, is a small dose of toxicology, but really it's sort of a nano amount of toxicology because nano is 1 to 100 nanometers, very small. You take the width of a hair and divide that, chop it up a few thousand times, you get down to a nanoparticle. And I think the problem with nanomaterial is that we're rushing into using nanomaterials in a lot of consumer products, and we haven't done all the research to determine their safety or the potential health effects or environmental effects of the nanomaterials. For example, you're exposed, you go out and put a little sunscreen on, you can get material that is either titanium or zinc, and these titanium dioxide compounds are nano-sized, are clear. So the material that we use, we take a titanium, it's white, it's used in paint, but if you nano-size that, it has different physical and chemical properties, so it becomes clear. So these materials that are nano-sized are very important changes in structure and function. And we're not looking into that. We're not considering them as new chemical entities, which, in my view, they should be considered, so we do a better tox assessment of these products. Nanosilver, for example, is another one that's been widely used. It's showed up in socks and people's underwear and clothing. And where does this stuff wash into? It washes into the environment. What are the consequences in the environment? Because nanosilver is a known microbial site. It's actually used for wounds, particularly for burns. So you have nano-sized silver I don't want to call them Band-Aid, but bandages that they would use to fight infections. Hmm. So we know that nano-sized particles, nano-silver, is toxic to bacteria. And so the question is, what's the consequences for human cells? Does it move across these cell barriers quickly? Where does it end up in the human body? Does it move into the liver? Does it move in the nervous system? And what are the consequences of that?
So is there some mindset around the people that are creating a lot of these products, like, well, they're so small, so they won't matter as much, or there won't be as much of an impact, or are they perhaps not even thinking about the impact at all, regardless of the size?
You know, I think they're thinking a little bit about the impact, but I think mostly they're thinking about how to make money from that. And they put nanoparticles in socks because they want to have deodorized socks, or your feet don't smell. They're not thinking about what happens when you wash your socks and where those nanoparticles go. Mm. They're saying, well, it's not a big deal. It just goes out into the waste stream. So the consequences are minor. There's not enough big deal about it. It's the same thing with, you know, pharmaceuticals. So we use a lot of pharmaceuticals. They flush down the toilet or we excrete them in our urine. They go into the water supply. They get into the sewage treatment plant. And we don't have a good system for removing them from the sewage treatment plant. So what are the consequences for them in the fish? And these endocrine disruptors, some of these compounds, produce intersex fish that have both female and male genitalia in the fish. And they're very confusing. So I think we're not thinking about future generations enough. We're not thinking about the consequences of what we're doing and really considering what might happen, what's going to happen in the future, what are the immediate environmental consequences and human consequences.
So what about those that say that none of this stuff is true and it's all like made up and that it's like all life is all taking its natural course and mankind and all of its actions are not responsible for the changes? It's all just a part of the natural cycle of things.
I think the data is overwhelming against that. I think you look at asbestos, you can look at lead, you can look at mercury. You know, mercury is contaminated fish, and we know the consequences of mercury. Look at Minamata, what happened to the fetal consequences of mercury exposure. Mercury is bioaccumulated, bioconcentrated in fish. It comes out of coal-fired utility plants, and EPA has just started regulating that a little bit more strictly. Right now, we ship coal, and there's a lot of talk about shipping coal from Montana, Powder River Basin, into China. And China burns that coal, and coal has mercury in it. And mercury contaminates the ocean, and it blows our way, and we end up contaminating our water with mercury. The mercury moves into fish. We contaminate one of the most important food sources on the planet, which is fish. And we know that that mercury has detrimental consequences to pregnant women, in particular to developing fetus. It is not good. It has developmental nervous system consequences. So we know that we can control environmental exposures. Asbestos is another great example. It causes mesothelioma. It's harmed hundreds and thousands of workers. Same with lead. You know, there's better ways to do things. You can look back, turn of the century, look at the Industrial Revolution, the consequence of that, and we're still making these mistakes. You see the consequences in developing countries like China and other countries that there's in
Mexico City.
Yeah. There's plants that are recycling batteries. They're not taking the precautions and smelting the lead out of these batteries. It's affecting the workers. The workers take home the lead to their families and really harms their children. I come back to that notion I said earlier. We have an ethical responsibility to ensure our children can reach, maintain their full potential. We know they don't when they're exposed to lead and mercury.
Mm. So is there any hope for any of this?
Well, I think there is hope. I think obviously we got to keep on living. We're going to keep doing things. But I think regulation is important. I think we need a level playing field. And I think that it's very important to be thinking about our human health, environmental health. And there's ways to do things. You can take the real shortcut ways, or you can pay a little bit more money and do that right.
Hmm. Oh, my goodness. So I got a list of here things that we wanted to touch upon because there's a lot here. I know that we can talk for a long time. I think your episode from last year was one of the longest ones we ever had. So
yeah, I could ramble on for a long time.
And I love it. Thank you for that. So what about we were talking about epigenetics.
Epigenetics.
What the heck is that?
Epigenetics. I think that's really, really important topic that's coming up. So epigenetics is we're affecting the epigenome. Usually you think of genetics affecting DNA, and you transmit information by the DNA, and you affect the DNA structure, and that passes on changes like your eye color, your hair color, affected by DNA. But what we're finding is that you can change the DNA so you affect the expression of the DNA. So you're changing the proteins that are expressed from the DNA. You're not changing the DNA, and you actually can pass this on to future generations. So environmental exposures to lead, mercury, endocrine disruptors in particular affect the expression of the DNA. And so that expression, particularly when you're developing, changes for the developing kid. That's why twins, although identical twins, turn out to be a little bit different here and there because their epigenome has changed and the epigenetics has changed. And I think that has really important implications for ethics. And that comes back to the precautionary principle, which says, you know, we're supposed to be thinking about future generations to take a precautionary approach. And just to digress for a second here, you know, when you put new drugs on the market with the FDA, the FDA has a very precautionary approach, the Food and Drug Administration. When you put new drugs on the market through the pharmaceutical and biotech companies, have to submit reams of data that talk about the effects of the chemical, does it do what it says it's supposed to do, and also look at the toxic effects of the chemical. We don't have a similar approach when we put new chemicals into the marketplace, so industrial chemicals. We don't have a precautionary approach. And I think what epigenetics says is that we really need a more precautionary approach because these chemicals can affect the epigenome and affect future generations. So we need a more approach that says we need to evaluate these chemicals before we put them out into the environment. For example, brominated flame retardants. We're probably sitting on brominated flame retardants. The question is, need chairs. What are the consequences of those? Do we really need these brominated flame retardants? And what are the consequences of exposure, particularly the developing organism?
I guess as long as we don't set the house on fire, we probably don't need them. So I'm a little confused about the epigenetics. Is that a type of research, or is that something that's just happening in society? Or
There's just more and more research about it. That some of the research was actually done in Western Washington University with vinclozamine, a fungicide, showing that it affects the epigenome. So we're just learning more about this, but I think it's going to have a really profound effect on how we think about the consequence of disease, how disease progresses. Like how in the future we have neurodegenerative disorders, things that happen to us as we age. What are the consequences of that? Is that because we had some change in our epigenome? Did that trigger a change in us as we age that accelerated some neurodegenerative process? So I think those are things we're going to have to think about and understand better. And I think it's going to really shed light on the mechanism of actions of the compounds we're exposed to.
So one thing that I noticed that you touched on that struck me was that you said that they seem to do, and I'm not even saying it's good enough or the right, but they seem to do a different type of research on things that are going into our body as opposed to the ones that are going out into our system and
right,
stuff.
They do.
And the truth of the matter is, from what I sense as being the right thing is, they both need to be treated equally.
We do, and we have this thing called chemical policy reform. And this comes back to TSCA. So the Toxic Substance Control Act was passed in 1976, which said there had to be some, EPA had to provide some approval for new chemicals to go on the market. In reality, it's just sort of pass through from industry, and EPA has, I think it's 60 days, and they have to then let the compound go. What we don't have is that precautionary approach. We're not requiring industry to submit a lot of chemical data. So in Europe, this is changing. They have a program called REACH, Registration, Evaluation, Authorization of Chemicals. So the REACH program is requiring industry to submit more data on the chemicals and understand their effects better. But TSCA being broken, we've been trying to get laws passed for toxic or chemical reform policy passed. There's actually got a committee this past year at the national level. At the state level, we've tried to do that through the Department of Ecology. I think it's very important for people to pay attention to this stuff because we need chemical policy reform. We need a program that requires industry, before they put a chemical on the market, that we understand whether it's bioaccumulative, whether it ends up in certain tissues. Bromate flame retardants, come back to that one. We found out they're bad actors when they started showing up in women's breast milk. This is not the time we put hundreds of thousands of pounds out into the environment to suddenly go, this compound's showing up in women's breast milk. What are the consequences of that? We should not be doing that. We have the tools and the procedures to study that stuff before it's mass-produced and it's all over the place in the environment. So we need fundamental reform of how chemicals are placed in the environment. And one of the things in addition to that is we need to have a law that says we should know what chemicals we're exposed to and what chemicals are in what products. Right now, you don't know all the chemicals that are in your personal care products that are used. You know, women were using nail polishes with phthalates in them. Made the fingernail polish a little more flexible on their fingernails. But what are the consequences of phthalates from an endocrine disruptor perspective? So that's exactly right. Okay, we don't know the paints that you use in your business.
But the nails sure look pretty, so that's all that matters, yeah.
But do you know all the chemicals in the paints that you use?
Oh, my goodness. No, I don't.
So that, I think that's an issue. We don't know all the chemicals they use in a fracking compound. So we don't know all the chemicals that are used in oil dispersants and oil spills. Industry claims this is confidential business information. My view is that this needs to be changed because they should not have privileges like that when they're exposing thousands of people to these chemicals. We should have a right to know what's in the products that we're using.
What's it going to take to change all this stuff?
It's going to take a lot of people, you know, really getting at legislators and really pushing to change. Washington State has been a leader in changing some of these things. We worked hard to get laws passed that got bisphenol A's out of baby bottles and kids' toys.
Oh, those are the BPAs?
This is the BPAs,
I heard of those, which is really great. Yeah.
We had a law that was passed that removed lead, cadmium, and phthalates from baby toys. This law was then watered down at the national level because the industry found it annoying to have a state law like that. But the last effort was defeated at Washington State. They tried to get some changes in chemical flame retardants again. But I think that was just shown that the guy that was arguing, a physician, was actually lying in his testimony to the legislature about the effects of these flame retardants. So this stuff goes on and on. The real point is that we should have this data. We should not have to settle this stuff in the legislative format where we spend a lot of our time arguing for changing these laws. We're really going on this chemical by chemical. What we really need is a policy approach to putting chemicals in the environment, not tackling this one chemical at a time.
So, I mean, this is some intense stuff. I mean, the stuff that we know about that they're fighting about in courts and the Supreme Court and stuff that you know, people, you hear that, you know, people are paying off these people for this. And, you know, then you hear about these things. What are they called? These, I call it like a green voucher that you can buy with money from somebody so your company can pollute because you're buying it's basically paperwork that says, you know, what do they call those things?
Yeah, carbon trading.
Carbon trading. I mean, and then now you're talking about
cap and trade.
That's the stuff that people to some degree know about, and there's so much more stuff that is just completely unknown that is potentially even worse.
Right. We just don't know, and we should know about this stuff. We should have basic studies done on the chemicals that we're producing in millions of pounds per year. There's almost 3,000 chemicals that are produced in over a million pounds per year, and we have very little data on the majority of those chemicals. And that's just something really wrong about that. You know, I think it's important to remember what Aldo Leopold said, that when he, you know, thing is wrong when you harm the integrity, stability, and beauty of the body community. When you do something that's harmful of that, you shouldn't be doing that. So it's very simple to have an ethical approach that says if you're harming the stability, beauty, and integrity, which you do if with children, you expose them to lead and mercury. You're taking away their beauty, integrity, and stability, and that's just wrong. And we continue to crank forward on this stuff because there's somebody making money from the process.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm going to try to restrain myself from not getting too too aggressive with my language and my thoughts and ideas about all this stuff, so we'll just keep moving along here. I know. One thing I was going to ask is, how many people are out there fighting for this stuff, fighting for these laws?
There's quite a few. There's a good number of people in different groups, and Seattle's been really fortunate to have people like Washington Toxics Coalition, the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, People for Puget Sound, which unfortunately just went bankrupt. They collapsed into a couple of organizations, but there's the Washington Conservation Voters Group, Washington Environmental Council. So Washington State, there's been a very good, solid group of people that have worked for policy reform at the state legislative level. And some of this is translated to national work, too. At the national level, there's Environmental Working Group, Washington, D.C. based, Defense Council. Environmental justice is really important. And so there's a lot of groups out there that are working hard on these issues. But that is, a lot of that work is drowned out by the push by industry to stop the laws and stop policy reform. And chemical policy reform is a great example that we have not been able to move chemical policy reform.
I'm not
forward.
Laughing. I'm just, that's my defense from crying. So
yeah, it's really in some ways discouraging.
Is it really doing anything? This work that these people are taking, or is it just like really slowing it down from the inevitable doom, or?
I think they really are doing good work.
The
struggle is
it's
funding.
It's not looking at the outcome. It's looking at what they're doing. Yeah. It's like the action and stuff.
You got to keep moving the stuff forward and try to fight for change in our laws and policy. And you saw, I think, Europe's moving ahead with this stuff. And the United States needs to catch up with what's going on in Europe.
Yeah.
And have more respect for the people and what's going on in the environment.
I think it'd probably take like places like China and India that have like the largest populations to really move towards this for really to be.
Well, yeah, you're right. Yeah. I think you see some really egregious examples of exposure to people, and there's other countries in Africa. I think another good place to look is actually electronic waste, e-waste. Where does the e-waste go? Mm. When we buy a computer or a laptop or a cell phone, are we paying anything for the dismantle and waste stream of that product? We're not.
Yeah.
And we need to do that because those products end up going over to India and China or Africa and being dismantled, but they're dismantled in an unsafe way, and kids are exposed to the chemicals that are in those products, and that's really harmful to the environment as well as to children and other people in the adults too, of the villages and people that are dismantling these products. So we need to be more thoughtful about our products. And as a developed country, we should be paying a little bit more for products. There should be laws that said, you manufacture it, you take it back. You make that computer, Apple makes a computer or Dell or Hewlett Packard, you have to take it back. And you have to build it so it can be dismantled safely and remove the hazardous material from it and reuse the chemicals and the material that's in it. There's some rare earth elements that are very valuable that could be reused from these products. And I just end up in a landfill or end up being smelted down in a haphazard manner.
And there really is. I mean, I'm not... I'm not going to get into that, but I think that there's definitely profit. I mean, I'm, for the pursuit of money is a whole nother topic, but on the pursuit of profit, but there really is business and stuff to be made from responsibility and recycling. And like you say, turning over the use and continuing the use and stuff like that. So it's not like that. It can't be, a useful thing, even from a business standpoint.
You're absolutely right. And there's good businesses. There's a good business here in Seattle that does recycling work. So
is RePC any good?
They're good. They're good.
Supposedly they say that they don't send off their stuff to third world countries and stuff like that to be.
Well, and there's a group called the Basel Action Network, BAN, and they have an e-stewards program that tries to get companies to sign on to a program where they're recycling their products, their electronic waste in a responsible manner. They're not shipping it to just dismantled in disreputable places, but actually good places we have it dismantled. So there are efforts. And again, this is right here in Seattle. The BAN is a really strong local organization that's working hard on these issues.
I heard there was a horrendous amount of pollution and waste and everything in Silicon Valley just from all of that stuff.
Yeah, probably, you know, the board manufacturer, you know. Hopefully they're doing a good job, but also a lot of stuff's being outsourced. You know, like what are the consequences of moving this stuff offshore where the environmental laws aren't as strict? And I think, you know, I've heard people want to roll back the EPA. And I was in China this past year.
Well, they want to eliminate it because they think that the world would be a better place if we don't have any kind of oversight.
And it really wouldn't be. Yeah. We took off from the Beijing airport and you could not see, literally could not see the end of the runway. And I'd like to send some of these people that want to roll back the EPA.
They don't have an EPA over there in China?
Well, they do, but they're not enforcing all the regulations. Yeah, so they're just the air quality is really poor. Yeah. And do we want to go back to that? You know, I would like to send the people that want to dismantle the EPA, go over and live in China with your family for 6 months and just experience the air quality that you could have back here.
Yeah.
We are very fortunate to have a strong EPA and FDA, too, looking at our drugs we use, the Clean Air Act. You know, the FIFRA, the Fungicide Act, and things like that, that really do protect human health. In my view, is a lot of this stuff needs to be strengthened. We need to pay a little bit more for energy and not just do it cheaply.
Oh, my goodness, Stephen. Let's see. Did we get into ethics precaution?
Epi precaution.
We probably didn't because I don't remember trying to talk like that yet.
I didn't get into that. I sidestepped that a little bit. Okay. That has to do with epigenetics. So what are the ethical perspective if you think epigenetics is important? And I came up with this term called epi precaution, where we need to have something beyond the precautionary principle. So the precautionary principle, again, is something that has a couple elements to it, but that says that we should be looking forward to future generations. We should accept some uncertainty in science and act, even if there is some uncertainty. You know, we don't have to have proof of everything. Classic example is tobacco industry, where they argue for years that cigarettes didn't cause cancer because nobody could, quote-unquote, prove it, where there's plenty of evidence that causation was the effect. So epi-precaution means we need to move beyond precaution because epigenetics, you can change the epigenome by exposure to chemicals, but also by the social environment. So if you have a poor upbringing, and this has been shown in animal studies, that the rat pups that were not well cared for by the mom had less poor outcomes than pups that are well taken care of. So their epigenome had changed. So epi-precaution says we need an environment that is really supportive. You have to do good. It's not good enough just to do no harm, which is the classic precautionary approach and ethical construct of do no harm. What you really need is do good. You have to have a loving, supporting environment, or otherwise you don't progress and develop as you should. So it's beyond precautionary principle, just like epi-precautions, beyond genetics, beyond the genome. It's the epigenome, epi-precaution is something beyond precaution. So
that's,
we have to do good.
Yeah, there's a lot of environmental justice involved in all of that.
It is. You're absolutely right.
I would love to do a show on. Love to do that.
Yeah. Do a show on environmental justice issues.
Yeah. Wow. So for those of us who haven't noticed, I wanted to ask you about your shaking. Michael does a fantastic job with the video, but I don't think he's going to be able to, to be able to clean that all up in post.
Yeah, no, I have a tremor, and that tremor is related to Parkinson's disease. So I have Parkinson's disease. And I think one of the interesting things, my nonprofit is the Institute for Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders. So it's sort of ironic, the director of the Institute for Neurotoxicology, Neurologic Disorders, gets a neurological disorder. So I think the interesting thing is, what might have caused that? How could I have prevented coming down with Parkinson's disease? Because the treatments for Parkinson's disease, there's a lot of annoying side effects with treatment. What you do is you don't want Parkinson's disease. You want to avoid it. You want to prevent it. So I think back to my own history, and I worked on cars a lot when I was a kid, worked with my dad, exposed to all kinds of solvents, you know, from painting cars to cleaning things up. I'm sure we cleaned gasoline, had lead in at that time. We used all kinds of acetones.
And then the things that we didn't use, like respirators and fans.
We didn't use respirators.
We just got right into it.
We didn't use gloves. You know, we got our hands all greasy and dirty. Yeah. Stick them in a bat of gasoline to wash them off. You know,
washes off their hands with gasoline.
Exactly. So did that help bring on my Parkinson's disease, or is it more genetically related? What was the cause of that?
Yeah.
So I think those are things to think about. Yeah. So I've been we need to do more research in Parkinson's disease, understand it better. And I'm really interested in how do we prevent disease like this, whether it's Alzheimer's or it's other disorders that we come through late in life, you know, ALS, multiple sclerosis, all these diseases that are more life, I don't know whether lifestyle, but, you know, that come with us, was there some epigenome that was changed in me? You know, what was the cause of my Parkinson's disease? That's what fascinates me.
So I got, because you're obviously spouting out a lot of great statistics and stuff, and that's, I really admire that, and I want to get one from you about over the course of history, that's recorded history and stuff, the rise or potentially lowering of the cases of the neurological disorders and different types of diseases that are caused by all the stuff that we're talking about. What are the statistics on all this stuff?
You know, statistics depend on which what you look at. So the incidence of these diseases has increased. I think breast cancer is a really great example of that, where it's about 1 in 7. And so the incidence of breast cancer has increased, even if you take in the greater population. And same thing with some of the neurological disorders. I'm not up on all that statistics for all that stuff, but there's been a greater incidence, even given the population base. Partly it's due to the we're aging, we live longer. But I think part of it's due to we're exposed to more chemicals, so we're seeing a rise in the incidence of some of these diseases. We've done a good job of treating cancer, but the times that cancer is caused, we're saying, well, there's been a drop in mortality associated with cancer.
Preventing cancer hasn't been the issue either.
Right. It's been treating the cancers. How do we prevent breast cancer? How do we prevent prostate cancer? You know, we know how to prevent mesothelioma, which comes from asbestos exposure. In, you know, stopping asbestos exposure. But still, we've had huge number of people with mesothelioma. And how do we prevent neurological disorders? You know, exposure to lead, exposure to mercury. How do we reduce the incidence of that? Like, I spent years working with lead and mercury in my research. Did that help? Was that also contributing to my Parkinson's disease? There's good data that show that Parkinson's disease is associated with pesticide exposure. So, and there's also some welding fumes, you know, manganese in particular. So welders have an increased incidence of Parkinson's disease. When I was a kid, we did welding in the garage. So, what you know, there's all this stuff. Multiple exposure to chemicals. Nobody would ever be able to pin down why I have Parkinson's disease because I was exposed to all kinds of stuff when I was growing up. But, you know, that's, I think, what we need to be thinking about.
I'm not a statistic person, not because I don't love it, because my brain doesn't work that way. But I'd heard something recently about cancer was like, say, and I'm throwing out some stuff that I can't really back up, but it's like 100 years ago. The rate of cancer in people was like one in every like 1,000 people. And now in this day and age, it's like it's said that like one in like 4 or 5 people will get some type of cancer in their lifetime. And it's like younger and younger. I mean, you can't turn on the news or go online or read something about a child and children and stuff have cancer. I mean, that couldn't have been the case 100 years ago, or was it? And I'm
well,
just don't know.
I think some of that's hard to determine. We're living longer. I think the diagnosis of diseases was not as good at that time, you know, as far as medical history goes. So I think the historical record is a little bit fuzzy.
Okay.
But I think in general, you know, we are seeing a greater incidence of some of these diseases, and we have to ask why and how do we – and I think, like I mentioned, I think breast cancer is one of the most obvious ones. Onset of multiple sclerosis has certainly increased. You know, what is the underlying reason for that? And it's not just because there's more people and we're living longer. You know, what kind of exposures are exacerbating the consequences of those diseases? So I think there's a lot. And is it the epigenome? Is it epigenetics? Is it genes? Is it, you know, because we're exposed to these chemicals right when we're growing up? And we're exposed to a lot of chemicals we're never exposed to before. Not to say that the turn of the century, you look at the industrial exposures and look at the rivers catching on fire, look at the poor air quality in London and other cities. It wasn't horrible. There weren't consequences of that. But, you know, that's it's different now. We're exposed to a lot of chemicals in our homes. We're exposed to chemicals in the toys we play with and the foods we eat. And we don't understand the consequences of all that.
Yeah, you'd think that as we, quote, unquote, advance as a society, this it would be moving into the opposite direction. The health and longevity and everything of our society would be better. But it doesn't seem to be working. Unless maybe I just not seen it the wrong
way.
Well,
a lot of it is a lot better. I mean, if you look at the diseases, you know, infectious disease in particular is really down. You know, people aren't dying of polio. We've done an incredible job of corralling polio, measles, some of the other cholera. A lot of diseases are down. The United States doesn't have a lot of malaria in it. There's a huge problem in other countries. But, you know, we've controlled a lot of sort of infectious-oriented diseases. What we're seeing now is a consequence of chemical exposure. We've tried to produce products because the population demands cheaper products. We want more of these products, and consequence of that is we get exposed to more chemicals. come along with these products, like the squishy rubber duckies that are fun to play with have phthalates in them. Yeah. So kids suck on those toys, they put them in their mouth. Yeah. What are the consequences of that? Are we really thinking through, and do we need kids playing with rubber duckies with phthalates in them?
They need to suck on like an organic carrot or something.
Exactly.
Something good for them.
Much better for them.
Sweet. Well, you got I love your glass half full attitude to the all this stuff going on. So, hey, we're going to take a break. We still got lots of stuff to talk about.
Okay.
We're here on episode 47 of Green Interviews, and we'll be right back with Stephen and the rest of the gang.
You are listening to Greener Views.
Gravity connects me to the earth, which connects me to people who connect me to myself more honestly. And gravity connects me to the crust, which connects to the leaves on the trees that make it possible to breathe. With naive mind shield like a helmet, they would tell us that we don't know how we feel or how to connect with other people on the planet. Oh, if we only knew the power in each blue disillusioned little. In the vision of one resides all, destroy the individual, for this is critical. The self ain't everything, hands to grasp, to cling, to mask material vastly shipwrecked beings. At last, release the greed amassed with capitalist tasks and contact the mass. Communication is all we have in dwindling fast.
Welcome back to episode 47 of Greener Views. We're back with Stephen Gilbert with from Toxopedia, a small dose of
toxicology.
Toxicology, a lot of stuff. Let's see. So there's a few other things that we'll get to here. Let's start out with, you talked about the small dose. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I talked a little bit more about small dose. So Small Dose of Toxicology was written a few years ago, initially published by Taylor and Francis, the first edition. And I was lucky enough to get the copyright back, so I've modified the book and upgraded all the chapters, added some new chapters in there, nanotech, world on ethics, but history of toxicology. And with each chapter of the book comes a PowerPoint presentation. So if you go to the website, it's now free. As an ebook, you can download as a PDF file, or as an EPUB for your iPad, or a Mobi file for your Kindle. And you can go through each chapter, and with each chapter comes a PowerPoint presentation that sort of summarizes the chapter, and you can use that to give your own lecture. So everything we do with Toxopedia and INND, we try to make open source, so you can have that information. If you go to the website, each chapter, you can look up and click on information on the chapters and go to web resources to delve further into the topic.
So what kind of stuff are they going to find in there?
Well, it's an introductory text. You got the principles of toxicology, and then you have chapters on nicotine, pesticides, lead, mercury, arsenic, metals, endocrine disruptors. So it's a general introduction. It's not doesn't go deeply into toxicology, but it gives you the health effects of common chemicals, sort of an introduction to that.
It's a good introduction to get people probably don't even know stuff like nicotine and caffeine as even being like toxic type things. They just think that it's something that's a part of their life.
Well, it gives you insight into how those chemicals work in your body, and you know, how a little bit about dose response. There's a chapter on risk assessment, how you evaluate effects of chemicals. How do you think about that? How do you work to understand what's behind the data? A little bit about different modes of evaluation of the chemicals, health effects of the chemicals in the environment. And each chapter is tried to written so it's standalone. So if you wanted to read about caffeine, you can do that, or you can flip to lead or mercury. You don't have to read the book from cover to cover. You can just sort of bounce around the book and read chapters that seem to be interesting. You can actually download each chapter as a PDF file. The EPUB files are the whole book, but the PDFs, you can download any chapter you want. Just read that. Read that. It's a bedtime story.
Dave, well, you're reading me about endocrine whatever.
Yeah, endocrine disruptors. Really important. So endocrine disruptors, they are chemicals. I think one of the most common endocrine disruptors that people might be familiar with are actually birth control pills.
Because
they're very powerful chemicals that affect the developing organism, but they also affect our bodies. We run on estrogen and testosterone, and you mimic these chemicals or have chemicals that mimic them. You can affect how we develop. You know, kids that have males that have are exposed to endocrine disruptors can have undescended testicles, hypophosphatia, where the urethra doesn't come out the end of the penis. It comes out earlier on, so it's a deformity. It has to be modified or corrected surgically. So there's a lot of effects like that. Girls can be affected by different means, you know, early breast development. So this is, you know, really important to be thinking about. The environment affects fish and affects frogs, amphibians, alligators it affects. So these chemicals are really powerful. It only takes a small amount of these chemicals to affect estrogen and progesterone, testosterone.
So what about, is this part of that or?
So this is what you're holding up there. It's called.
This is an Arabic on this side?
It's an Arabic on one side.
And then it's not English on the other side.
So this is a milestones of toxicology poster. And each square looks at a different incident in toxicology to help get people information. If you open up this as a PDF file, you can click in each square and get more information. It's also been translated into French, German, Italian, Russian, Arabic, and Spanish and Portuguese. So we're trying to translate a new language and spread it around.
Is that part of a small dose or is that something else?
It's part of small dose. You can download it from the Toxipedia website. It's part of small dose. And it's our effort, again, to try to make information accessible. I said earlier on that we have tremendous amounts of knowledge out there, and we're just touching this very surface of this stuff. And the idea with Toxipedia was to be a resource for people that wanted, you know, unbiased information that's supported by the facts, and to get people with expertise to contribute knowledge. I think it's been one of the challenges of Toxipedia is to get more contributions to Toxipedia of people that are knowledgeable. Like, I know a little bit more than most about lead and mercury, but I don't know everything about pesticides or arsenic or some of the other metals, and we need more information about those. We need people that have expertise in those areas to provide more information about them. And we have to develop systems that share knowledge and make knowledge accessible to people.
Yeah. So for some reason, how do we get Toxipedia, which is to me sounds just as important as Wikipedia, but doesn't seem like people care about endocrine destructors or detractors as much as some hair metal band from like 1983.
Well, I think that's a challenge. That's a huge challenge. I have huge respect for Wikipedia, and we use Wikipedia a lot. They've got a lot of knowledge, but it's just independent information. I think in Toxipedia, our goal is to link it together to tell more of a story of the toxicity. So you look at the historical impact of toxicological information. How does it connect? How do we put information in the context of history, society, and culture? I think that's what we have to do. And I think hopefully Wikipedia will gradually move more in that direction where it's telling a bigger story of the incident. So putting, linking the people in there, who was responsible, who contributed in the past, what lessons can we learn from these incidents we have?
So let's talk about this next. Particles on the Wall, so, second edition.
Sweet. Particles on the Wall. This is put out by Healthy World Press again, as was Small Dose of Toxicology. So Particles on the Wall is an exhibit that we put together that focuses on Hanford. But the idea was to unite the arts and sciences to forge a more healthy and peaceful world. Because, again, we have lots of information, but we wanted to bring the arts together. So we have visual arts along with poems and science factoids. So with Hanford, in the history of plutonium, and just a few words about Hanford. You know, it wasn't too long ago, August was the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima in Japan, which killed hundreds of thousands of people. But the plutonium that destroyed Nagasaki was actually produced in Hanford at the B reactor. And the B reactor is now a national monument, but there were 8 reactors along Columbia River that produced plutonium. The sole purpose of the reactor at Hanford, except for the N reactor, a little bit of history there, was to produce plutonium. They were not to produce energy or electricity, just plutonium. Now there is a Energy Northwest has a power plant out there that does produce electricity, and they recirculate the water. But Hanford initially was just there to produce plutonium. It's now the most contaminated site in Western Hemisphere, and we're spending billions of dollars to clean up Hanford. It's a classic example of us crashing forward. There's a huge rush to produce plutonium, and they produced a lot of plutonium, but they did not take care of the material that they used to produce plutonium. They put it in big tanks. These tanks are leaking. They now have a plan to vitrify this, which is to turn this chemical and radiological waste into glass log to store it so it doesn't easily leak out of these big storage tanks, and the leaking is heading toward the Columbia River. So they got a huge challenge, but it's a challenge that we didn't have to take on if we had planned ahead, if we'd gone a little bit more slowly and taken care of the waste that was produced. And this is generally a huge problem with nuclear power overall. And Particles on the Wall was an effort to raise people's awareness of Hanford, but in the broader context of the nuclear issue in general, and where does the waste go from the nuclear power plants? The nuclear power plant that's at Hanford, on Hanford Reservation, actually in Richland, is a boiling water type reactor, the GE reactor, same as the ones that were in Fukushima. We saw the consequences of Fukushima, where they have these the spent fuel rods that are used in the reactor. So the reactor uses uranium rods to generate the energy to boil water. And when these rods are used, they still are generating a lot of heat. They're stored in these big pools. The big pools are hundreds of feet in the air, and they're not encased or protected like the nuclear reactor is. And they have enormous amounts of radiation in them. And the reactor in Fukushima, reactor number 4, it was offloaded. So all the fuel rods out of the reactor was in these cooling pools. And the whole world is really fortunate that the reactor number 4's fuel storage area didn't collapse. Because if that had collapsed, it would have strewn all kinds, particularly cesium-137, out into the environment. So we are not thinking ahead. Right now, there's no storage place for the fuel waste that's coming out of our nuclear reactors. The United States has over, I think it's around 140 reactors in the United States. We don't have a place to store the nuclear fuel.
Yeah, we do in the middle of the earth. Don't we just open up a hole and dump it in?
Well, they looked at Yucca Mountain for that stuff, but they backed away from doing that. And right now, a lot of the fuel is just stored at the reactor. We've got all these waste sites distributed all over the country. So we need to think. In general, we need to think more. But coming back, I want to say a couple more words about particles in the water.
Sure, I want to hear about it.
Because we're really thrilled with this. It's an exhibit. It's a traveling exhibit. It started off at the Allegro Cafe at the University of Washington, for people that are familiar with that.
Yeah.
So we started off as a very small exhibit, and we produced our first Particles on the Wall book from exhibits there. And we gradually progressed, and previously it was at the Allegro Odegaard Library at the University of Washington. It was our biggest exhibit, and then it's now going to be up at the Central Washington University in Ellensburg. So it's going to go into a real museum setting, and this book is sort of commemorate that event. But we've got a lot more material going up at Central Washington University. So we're really thrilled to see Particles on the Wall really progress from a very small coffee shop all the way up to a real museum exhibit. And this book is part of that sort of document we've done, but also give people a way to look at visual arts, look at the poetry. So we're looking at the heartfelt, what are the consequences of living at Hanford, living in that area, living in Richland, you know, working at Hanford Nuclear Reservation. What are the consequences of people? What was it like living there? Having people talk about through the poetry and visual arts, but also the science. So the science helped inform the literary arts and visual arts, and the visual arts help inform the science. So we've tried to bring these things together, and I think we need to bring our heads and our hearts together to talk about subjects as complicated at Hanford. And really, many of the subjects we have to deal with, we need to have a more comprehensive way to think about these things and not just isolate them, focus on the science, but we need to focus on both our heads and our hearts, and understanding and appreciating the consequences of what we're doing.
And how do people get a hold of Particles on the Wall?
So Particles on the Wall is it has a print copy of it that you can email me and get a copy of that. I'll send it to you. You know, we charge $25 to $30. We usually ask for donation, and it's also free as an ebook, so you can download it as a PDF file. And the PDF file is actually the way to do it, so it keeps the pages really nicely the way the format in the book. Or you can load it down as an e-file for your iPad or your Kindle. So it's a Mobi file and an EPUB. So they're both up on particlesonthewall.org is a website. And we'll actually, hopefully in the next month, we're going to spin that off into another much more interesting website. But on that website, you can look at the visual arts or some of the poetry independent of the book. So all the material's there. The book, I think I'm very proud of the book. It's been a fun project. And I hope your listeners will take a look at this book. So particlesonthewall.org.
Yeah, you know, I remember when I was a kid hearing about Three Mile Island what was the other
Chernobyl.
Chernobyl and stuff. And I just I didn't really know what that stuff meant, but it just sounded horrific. And
Three Mile Island, the United States dodged a huge bullet. Chernobyl was a horrible incident, and it was really tragic what happened with that. Many people were killed. A lot of kids were affected because of iodine-131. And iodine is one of the sort of waste products produced. It has a short half-life, but it concentrates in the thyroid. So a lot of kids got thyroid cancer in Chernobyl because they did not acknowledge the disaster as it unfolded. But that was a reactor that didn't have any containment vessel on it, graphite-fired reactor core. But I think that was a progression of trying to have reactors that produce energy. The boiling water reactor that GE developed that was at Fukushima and out at Hanford has a reactor encasement, but it's still vulnerable to a lot of problems. And we are not, again, I think this is another instance, we're not thinking ahead to future generations, the consequence of nuclear power. We need more conservation. We need to move more alternative energy sources.
Well, Stephen and I were talking before the show and then at the break about all this stuff. And we do want to make sure that we do a show specifically about nuclear power and stuff because it's something that's near and dear to me.
Yeah, I think that'd be a really good idea. And I also want to mention that, you know, one thing we tried to look at Hanford, and we had a grant from the Department of Ecology, we tried to look at the worldwide consequences of Hanford. Because the plutonium that was generated at Hanford was set off the Marshall Islands, the Marshallese. Their environment was really shattered by the nuclear weapons that were tested at the Marshall Islands. Some of the Marshallese are here in Seattle area. There's some in Hawaii. There's some living on the islands. But their environment was really shattered by the testing of these nuclear weapons. Many of them were affected by the nuclear exposure. And also, there's an enormous number of weapons set off in Las Vegas, right outside of Las Vegas.
Nevada, yeah, they have like
Nevada nuclear test site.
Yeah.
And if anybody is at Las Vegas, goes to Las Vegas, take a day off from gambling or seeing the shows, and go to the Nuclear Testing Museum. It's actually walkable from the center of Las Vegas, and you can walk to the Nuclear Testing Museum. It's an easy cab ride. But it's a really interesting museum that explores the consequences and the number of nuclear weapons that were tested. More over 1,000 nuclear weapons were tested, some of them in the air, and the majority of them underground, but you can see the consequence of that. If you're really ambitious, you can actually take a tour of the nuclear test site. And I would recommend definitely a tour of the B reactor to go see the B reactor that produced plutonium that destroyed Nagasaki. And a lot of this plutonium was destroyed or used Las Vegas, the Marshall Islands. But we also have many submarines and nuclear weapons that still have plutonium in it. Hanford generated over 2/3 of plutonium that's in the nuclear arsenal of the United States. A lot of that sits at the Bangor submarine base off of Bremerton, which is one of the largest concentrations of nuclear weapons in the world. 20 miles from the heart of Seattle is the largest concentration of nuclear weapons. So I think we need to pause and think about that and, you know, really acknowledge the consequence of nuclear weapons and what was done in Nagasaki and Hiroshima in Japan. The number of people that were killed there is really, really, if you stop to think about that, it's really a pretty horrific story. And we need to be more thoughtful about things like this.
You know, if I would have known you were one of those damn hippies that was against nuclear explosions and nuclear weapons, I would have thought otherwise about having you on the show. I mean, I would love to talk about this stuff like all the time because I'd love to know. But I'm not even going to ask any more questions because it's just going to continue to go more and more on this. But we're going to talk about setting up either yourself or somebody else to just specifically talk about nuclear.
That'd be great.
So let's get into... you know, you're talking about not wanting all that war and nuclear weapons and stuff, and this is the point where we get into the kind of the hippy-dippy part of the interview and ask a little bit deeper about yourself and some of your feelings. What is the motto or mission statement for your life?
My motto and mission statement is to make sure that people can reach and maintain their full potential. I think that's the motto. It's really important to me that I want to make sure that children are exposed to chemicals they're not need to be exposed to, that we have an opportunity to reach and maintain their full potential. I think everybody should have that opportunity. And we expose the kids dismantling our e-waste, or we expose the kids in factory work. They are not able to reach and maintain their full potential. And I think we take advantage of many people, adults also. They reach and maintain. So we're exposing adults to lead or mercury or other chemicals in the workplace or in our home environment. They can't reach and maintain their full potential either. So that's my working motto. What really motivates me, you know, day after day, is try to create knowledge and try to motivate people, create policies that allow people to reach and maintain their full potential.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. So why don't you tell us about somebody who's had the greatest impact on your life so far in your life?
Living or dead or anybody?
Anybody.
Anybody? So people had the greatest impact. So I think, you know, when I was growing up, I came out of the Vietnam War, I think Gandhi had the greatest impact in my life. And I read a lot about Gandhi and really, you know, the nonviolent approach. I've been a vegetarian since I was 20, so I've been a vegetarian for over 40 years now. And I think that nonviolence, we need to be more thoughtful about that and have a way to settle our disputes as not resort to killing people or slaughtering them or shooting them or blowing them up or dropping bombs on them using drones. And we need to have mechanisms in our society that is not that uses nonviolence as a way to resolve our disputes. And I think a lot of that starts with education. We need better education, but people, we need free education. You know, we need to promote people's understanding. We need to promote education throughout the world. We need more women educated. We need education and nonviolence.
Hmm. So do you have a recent book or movie that you've seen or read that's been inspirational to you?
You know, I just finished a book on Hanford. I talked about talking about Hanford. Really, it really focused a lot about the people that were involved in Hanford, talked about the secrecy there. And I think the most recent person was Bill Withrop, who we dedicated Particles on the Wall to. He was a poet. He passed away a few years ago. But he had a huge impact on me. He was a pretty radical guy. Some of his poems were very angry, but he was really, really inspiring person that really provided me with, you know, motivation. You know, Bill was real character about stuff. And so another book that I just started reading is The Accidental Slave Owner. And that was by Mark Oshlander, who's now at Central Washington University. But he talked about slavery. And got to me thinking about, you know, we still have slavery, you know, whether it's sexual slavery or exploitation of people, you know, around the world.
Animals.
Animals. Yeah. A really great example of that. But the book was, you know, talking about exploitation in the South, Southern United States, and the impact a little bit on the North. But, you know, it's getting me thinking about all those issues again. So that's been a book that I'm just getting started into that's been really interesting.
I need to get him on the show. What was the name of the book, the Hanford book? You didn't say the name of that one.
Talking About Hanford. So it was really, really good book. It's not a real long book. But it has a lot of really great material, particularly, like I said, about people in Hanford and about the generals, how Hanford was constructed, getting the first reactors up and going, the problems with getting the reactors. Initially, the reactor didn't work well, you know, how that happened, you know, what the consequences were. And, you know, talked about the people that were really involved in the science as well as sort of the nuts and bolts of making it happen. So you look at the B reactor, and it is an engineering, amazing engineering feat that this could be built in such a short amount of time and actually work and generate the plutonium. And there was the first plutonium-based weapon that was set off with the Trinity explosion itself down in Los Alamos, near Los Alamos. And there was a test weapon that came out of the plutonium that was produced at Hanford out of the B reactor. So I would encourage everybody to go take a look at the B reactor and just stand in that building and contemplate the consequences, both of its construction, but also what it was used for and sort of the unfortunate side of producing plutonium. And there's good argument to say that we did not need to set those weapons off and kill all those people in Japan.
Yeah. So you're saying killing people is not a good thing?
Killing people is just not the way to go. It just astonishes me that we're still doing that.
Yeah.
You know, at this late date in human development, why are we fighting these wars? Why were so many people killed, you know, in these wars and conflicts? And you know, senselessly, why did 9/11 happen? You know, why people drive planes into buildings, people, you know, kill other people, they rape and torture people. Can't we move beyond this stuff?
We're hoping so.
We're hoping so.
So aside from all that, is everything okay over there, guys?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, sweet. That's the kind of stuff I like to hear. Aside from all this, one thing I sense about you, and I know that I've spoke with you before, is that and we mentioned it earlier in the show, is that you do have a generally positive and productive attitude in life. How do you maintain such a positive attitude?
Well, I like what I do, and I think we all just have to keep moving forward with this stuff. You know, it's the only changes by making arguments about why it should change and how it should be different. You know, in human nature is what it is. I think we all have seen streaks of violence in people.
Yeah.
And I think we just got to keep working against that. We got to have a society that values people. I think, you know, if you really get me going on this, we need to move away from the rigid capitalistic structure we have. Corporations cannot just have only responsibility for making money. So corporations, they have fiduciary responsibility to make money for their shareholders. They don't have any responsibility to good citizens, but it's sort of driven upon them. So we need to have a different, modified approach to business. I mean, capitalism does a good job of a lot of things. It's very efficient in some ways, but in other ways, it's very inefficient, and it exploits things. Business owners exploit the environment. They externalize costs, and you externalize costs on the environment, on the other people. And we have to have a different approach to that.
So what's one thing that most any person can do to have a positive impact in the world?
I think the most important thing to do is go talk to your legislative representative. Go tell him or her that you want change in the environment. You want to have everybody to be able to reach and maintain their full potential, and they want chemical policy reform. You want people, you don't want corporations as people. You want corporations to take responsibility for the environment, for social responsible way. And you can engage your legislative folks. They work for us. Vote and talk to your legislative folks. Everybody should write to them. Get engaged with those people.
Great. So how can listeners get the word out about all of the things that you're doing, and how do people get a hold of you?
So it's pretty easy to find me, Toxopedia, toxopedia.org, smalldoseup.org, particlesonthewall.org. My email is sgilbert@ind.org. So I'm easy to find, and I love to talk to people. And I think you can look up a lot of the information on Toxopedia, the other websites, Integrated Pest Management website, IPMOpedia, World Library of Toxicology. There's Toxicology History, and we have a lot of other fun things we didn't talk about much. We have posters on Toxopedia of different historical events in toxicology called the Toxicology History Room. You can check that out. We have a thing called Lessons Learned. There were 50 lessons learned about different things I wrote up about, usually fairly short, about different incidents in toxicology. You can check out the poster, Milestones of Toxicology. So I think to me, the fun part is learning about this stuff, because we are engaged in toxicology all the time. We're all risk assessors. We're all looking at chemical exposure, whether it's caffeine or it's nicotine or it's drugs that we're consuming, you know, to help our health, or it's other chemicals we're exposed to. Toxicology is everywhere. It's all around us. I think it's important for us to learn and understand the basic principles of toxicology, so we're making good decisions. It's only with knowledge that we can make better decisions with our environment and figure out ways to protect human health.
Do you talk about stuff like the history, like DDT and Agent Orange and stuff like that?
It's all there.
It's all there.
Rachel Carson, DDT, Agent Orange, and what are the consequences of that? And we have sections on fracking. We have sections on oil dispersants. We have pesticides, big sections of pesticides, whole list of chemicals. And, we cover a lot of territory. We're always looking to expand the site. And, you know, I think we have a toxicology of today. So I tweet every day. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet almost every day about little incidents in toxicology, a very short thing. You can find more information on Toxopedia. So there's a lot. We have a newsletter that comes out. Sign up for our newsletter.
Sweet. Well, listen, it's been wonderful. We always end out with the one piece of wise advice or words of wisdom or word of wisdom or some helpful hints. So what do you got for us? That you haven't had a whole truckload that you've been spilling on us for the whole time, but
my word of wisdom, not to be too heavy here, but I think we have an ethical responsibility to make sure our children can reach and maintain their full potential. So we have a responsibility to help children out, and I think we have to take that seriously and be really cognizant of that. And we have a lot of control over our environment, and if we exercise it. So children should have an opportunity to reach and maintain their full potential. And we, as adults, should be doing that.
Well, that certainly doesn't sound too heavy to me. That doesn't sound heavy enough. thank you so much.
It's really been great.
And we're going to be doing some stuff together and working some stuff and getting some more great guests like Steven on here. So, everybody, thanks. It's been episode 47 of Green Reviews. And on behalf of Randy and Michael and myself, thank you. Yeah, please, if you'd like to advertise or sponsor or donate or send feedback, if you'd like to work or help out on the show, not that we make any money, but if you'd like to work on the show anyhow, and please check out info@greenreviews.net or call us at 206-650-4587. Please check out ambrosiadigitalmedia.com. And healthyhomecast.com. And I think that's it. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Daryl. You're great.
You're welcome. You're great, too. You got to wave, though.
Wave, though. Bye-bye.
The show is not complete unless you wave. Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Greener Views is part of the Healthy Homecast Network. Check out all their conscientious and sustainably focused podcast programs and businesses at healthyhomecast.com. Greener Views is created, developed, and produced by Daryl Whalen. Our audio engineer is Randy Parcell. Our video producer is Michael Schwartz of AmbrosiaDigitalMedia.com. Music for this episode was provided by SlapJazz.com, DanFajans.Bandcamp.com, and jdhobson.com. Your feedback is important. Please feel free to contact us with any comments or questions, including suggestions for guests and program topics. You can call us at 206-650-4587 or send a direct email to info@greenerviews.net. Be sure to check back often. New episodes coming soon.